Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Ty Bannerman. With protests continuing across the country in the wake of the police killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and many other black people, folks are questioning the role of law enforcement and imagining different ways of ensuring public safety. This week on Let's Talk New Mexico, we will discuss a spectrum of possible changes to New Mexico's police forces that people are calling for, from reform efforts to change how police respond to nonviolent calls, to more radical proposals that seek to eliminate traditional policing altogether. And we want to hear from you. What are your concerns about law enforcement? Can New Mexico communities trust police to protect and serve? Has the Black Lives Movement the Black Lives Matter movement affected the way that you think about policing? Give us a call this hour at 277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org and we'll get your comments on the air. My first guest is here to recap an incident involving police that's at the top of people's mind for many in Albuquerque this week. The shooting of a man near a statue of colonizer Juan de Oñate Monday, as protesters tried to tear it down. KUNM's Marisa DeMarco was there and is a friend of the victim, who is hospitalized in stable condition. Marisa, thanks for being with us.
Hey, good morning, Kai.
So tell us, what did you experience right before and after those shots were fired?
Yeah, so, when I got there, there had already been a couple of hours of a candlelight vigil in the park. But now there was like maybe 50 or 75 demonstrators who are kind of up on the monument, and also members of the New Mexico Civil Guard, which is an armed militia group that's been patrolling protests. They were there in, military gear, carrying these big rifles. And there was, some shouting and arguing. Demonstrators were telling them, we don't want you here, go home. And then I was standing there, and this guy grabs this girl from behind and just throws her to the ground, like right in front of me. And she smacked her head on the pavement super hard. And as she was going down, she knocked the recorder out of my hands, which is, not important really, but beyond being kind of a time peg, right?
Right.
I kneeled down and I was, putting that recorder back together. And the demonstrators were trying to get the woman who hit her head. They were trying to get her head to hold still and like her neck, cause she looked hurt and she looked out of it.
She
right
down pretty hard.
Yeah. I mean, her head like bounces on the pavement. It's rough. And I saw it. I was right behind her. And so as I'm trying to get all the pieces of my recorder and put them back together, I hear these gunshots. And I was hoping that they were, someone had just fired in the air or that they're firecrackers or, something. So I pushed through the people and I see someone laying in the street. And when I get closer, I realize that it's actually a good longtime friend of mine who's been shot. And I could see, I saw a bullet wound in his shoulder and one on his back, but I think there are more than that.
Yeah.
And so as I walked up, there's these protest medics who are just, demonstrators who come with first aid gear.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like pressing on the wounds with their hands, to try to stop the blood flow. Yeah.
That sounds like a really hard thing to be witness to. And I think I'm glad you were there to see it as it happened and to kind of give us those facts. Now, you've been covering these protests for weeks now. These armed civilian groups like the New Mexico Guard have been there. I do want to point out that as far as we know, that Stephen Baca, the shooter, was not a member of the New Mexico Civil Guard. But do you feel like the presence of these armed civilian groups like contributes to an atmosphere?
Oh, for sure. And we've been reporting, I noted them at the first protest that I covered, which was the demonstration that concluded. And then later on in the night, there was people were smashing windows downtown and it turned into this whole situation with tear gas and riot police. But as I was out there and people were smashing windows, I was thinking, because I'd been seeing these dudes all night, I was wondering if one of them was going to, like, try to intervene and if we'd be looking at a shooting or, like, a mass shooting or, you know what I mean? Like, everybody is cognizant of their presence and everybody is worried about them, right? And I want to say, too, that so the person who pulled, this is really important, returning to Monday night, the person who pulled this girl down and she smacked her head, he goes running away, and that's why he was being chased, is because he looked like he had just hurt someone real bad.
Right.
And so, and he turns out to be the shooter. So he's getting chased by the demonstrators, and then he turns around and shoots my friend.
Right.
And the demonstrators were yelling, like, get his license plate number. You know what I mean? Like, they're trying to make sure he doesn't get away with hurting this person.
Now, we're talking about the police today, of course. Where were they when this was taking place?
I did not see any police officers present. And then after the shooting, it's like several minutes before they show up. And so my friend is in the street, and he's bleeding, and I'm calling his name. And, you know, he like, looked at me and nodded to, like, let me know that he heard me, you know. And the shooter's still there, too. Like, the shooter's still there, surrounded by civil guard guys, you know, and so then the police come, and they come as SWAT and riot police, and they take the civil guard and the shooter, Stephen Baca, into custody, and then the riot police just really start, like, pushing the protesters out of the street, and the whole time I was just wondering, like, why aren't they telling people, like, hey, we need you to back up so we can get an ambulance through here, and this is a crime scene now, and we'll need to interview you, or, you know, like, I just didn't know why there was such aggression and not any explanation. I really think people would have complied. People were really scared, and I think that situation could have manifested differently. As it was, it ended up being like a 90-minute or two-hour, like, standoff with protesters. There's tear gas. There's, you know, less lethal munitions. There's, you know, just on and on and on. And it just, as I think about it this morning, I just feel like it did not have to go down like that, you know?
And it seems like Bernalillo District Attorney Raul Torres agrees with you. He said yesterday that APD's heavy tactics against protesters after the shooting made it impossible for key witnesses to make statements to the police. Plus, there were undercover officers apparently on the scene that did not intervene when things were escalating. What aspects of police response in this case do you think need further scrutiny?
That definitely the police response, the lack of, it seemed to me like, interviewing people, like, reporters, there's a couple reporters on the scene. They're all interviewing folks. Like, I'm trying to talk to people, you know, but everybody's in this weird situation. And you have to think about the demonstrators, too. Like, these are all people who experienced a crime, who are scared, who, you know, who had either had violence done to them before that or who just saw someone get shot, you know, like, Those are, and they were not armed. The demonstrators didn't have any guns, you know. As far as I know, there was no guns on display. I was there the whole time, and it's not that many people. We're talking about, I don't know, at later on, we're talking probably like 30 to 50 people or something. Like, it's not that many folks.
Right.
So that definitely deserves scrutiny, and I really think that there needs to be more scrutiny. And we've been writing about this. We've been reporting on this. There needs to be more scrutiny about the relationship between these militia groups and law enforcement and whether there's collaboration or how much.
And we are going to be talking about that a little later on today. I did want to ask you one more question about the actual incident. There are, you know, conflicting reports and rumors and things going around on the internet, but just to clarify, did you see the shooting victim? Was there any evidence that he had a knife or any other weapon besides a skateboard?
No, I didn't. I didn't see any weapons on him. And also, I guess I'm unclear who swings the skateboard.
Okay.
Because there's a couple of people chasing after this guy, yeah. You know. But even so, I mean, I guess there's different ways to look at this. And clearly, like, I normally am a reporter. And in this capacity, I just suddenly turned into not a reporter.
Right.
Because it was my friend who was shot.
Yes.
But, like, honestly, like, you know, I think the Santa Fe New Mexican had an editorial about bringing a gun to a skateboard fight, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, even if somebody's swinging a skateboard, like, I don't know.
Yeah. Does that count as incentive to use deadly force or what have you? I guess that's for the courts to decide at this point. Well, thank you so much for being on the phone with us and kind of giving us that eyewitness account and personal account. I know that was a hard thing for you to experience, so thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thanks, Ty.
So joining us by phone today is Zoe Kraft. She is the co-founder of Fight for Our Lives, a youth-led organization that has been acting in support of Black Lives Matter and efforts to release prisoners during the coronavirus pandemic. Good morning, Zoe.
Hi there. How are you?
We're doing okay here. So you've been at various demonstrations in the last few weeks, including the one on Monday night. What's your take on police response during these protests?
So I would say overall, the police response during the protests, both the protests on Monday, as well as especially the Black Lives Matter protests in the past few weeks, has been really, really violent and very much an overreaction on the part of APD when it comes to crowds of peaceful protesters. We have seen, I was at a Black Lives Matter action a few weeks ago on Thursday that resulted in a crowd of protesters being tear gassed. And these were completely peaceful protesters. It was a group of about maybe 30 to 50 people. And we also saw this occur on Monday where the suspects in the shooting that occurred on Monday had already been detained. And then that crowd of peaceful protesters that was unarmed, the only ones who had been armed were the militia members and Stephen Ray Baca. We saw them being, we saw the peaceful protesters who were unarmed being tear gassed, rubber bullets were used against them, as well as flashbangs, which seemed like an extremely unnecessary show of force and state violence against our community.
Now, Albuquerque police state that they come to these demonstrations to protect demonstrators as well as bystanders. Have you found that to be the case?
I have not actually found that to be the case. I would say in a lot of ways, the presence of APD has actually endangered our community more than it has helped protesters to feel safe, especially pointing to a continuing pattern similarly to what we saw on Monday. Of the police ignoring the aggressions of groups such as the New Mexico Civil Guard, the militia group that was present on Monday, and then using extreme force against the protesters that were there for the original event. I think in many ways, APD further escalates situations and uses unnecessary force almost constantly, especially against our minority communities, our communities of color, our Black communities. And I definitely don't think that they do an adequate job of keeping protesters safe.
Okay. So we do need to go to a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. Are you a listener who works in or alongside law enforcement? How do you think police in New Mexico could improve their services to the public? Let us know. Our phones aren't working at this exact moment, but you can email us at letstalk@kunm.org or tweet to the hashtag letstalknm.
The Rothstein Donatelli Law Firm is committed to supporting KUNM, where the law firm's criminal practice can help clients petition state courts to permanently remove public records related to criminal charges and certain convictions. RothsteinLaw.com.
Support comes from Il Vicino Wood Oven Pizza Restaurants, safely offering curbside pickup at all locations from 5 till 8 and delivery service through DoorDash 7 days a week. Call-in orders accepted and can be placed online through ilvicino.com.
Alaska's been spared the high coronavirus infection rates of most other states, but cases are on the rise. Many rural villages have few medical resources to adequately tackle a major outbreak. We'll check in with a few of those villages to see how they are preparing on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman, and now we are taking your calls. What are your most pressing concerns about policing in New Mexico? How can we improve public safety in our state? Give us a call at 277-5866 and share your ideas. I am talking to Zoe Kraft, the co-founder of Fight for Our Lives, a youth-led organization that's been out there supporting Black Lives Matter and efforts to release prisoners, etc. Zoe, I wanted to ask you, Fight for Our Lives just published an open letter advocating for Mayor Keller to disband the Albuquerque Police Department. Why do you feel that that is the solution rather than more incremental reforms?
Yeah, so the Albuquerque Police Department was actually investigated in a federal investigation multiple times, but primarily in 2014 by the Department of Justice. And during that investigation, the Department of Justice ultimately concluded that there was a culture and pattern of violence against the people of Albuquerque, particularly in minority communities and poor communities. And following that investigation, there were over 200 requirements that came out for APD, which were essentially reforms to help to prevent APD from using unnecessary violence. But even since those requirements have technically on paper been met, many of them have, some of them have still, we still see Albuquerque as either the first or second in the nation for deadly police shootings, depending on the year, even following that DOJ investigation. So in a lot of ways, it seems like previous efforts to reform APD have not been successful, and they remain one of the most deadly police forces in the entire nation. So this seems like the only way to ensure that marginalized communities don't continue to be killed by our police department.
So if the police were disbanded in the city, what would you want to replace them with?
So Fight for Our Lives would really call for community-based solutions. So, for example, we saw the crisis call that occurred to APD a week ago, where someone in mental health crisis was ultimately killed. We would advocate for, instead of an armed police response, a response that includes social workers, a response that includes people trained in de-escalation tactics, and people who are really, who are really trained in de-escalation and have thorough mental health training and background in whatever the situation that's occurring may be.
Now, that sounds, you know, very, very big picture solutions. I'm sure many folks at home are wondering right now, well, if we don't have police, what would happen if they were the victim of a crime that was occurring right now that can't be addressed with, you know, social work in the community?
Right. So I think that the concept of disbanding the police doesn't necessarily completely eliminate all forms of law enforcement. It just eliminates the system as it exists because reforms haven't been working so far, so that we can work to build build back a new structure from the ground up. So the majority of that system would be unarmed responses, responses focusing on de-escalation, but there would still be some sort of solution in place to deal with violent crimes that occur or immediate emergencies and crimes against citizens. I don't think we're advocating for completely removing those resources so that there's no help and no solution for those who are in an emergency situation. We're just advocating for rebuilding the system from the ground up so that the reforms that have previously not worked can actually work to protect the communities which they're supposed to help.
Okay, it looks like we have a call from Casey in Albuquerque. Good morning, Casey. What would you like to add to the conversation today?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a retired Albuquerque police officer. I have my own perspectives on problems within the Albuquerque Police Department. The first is not good supervision. Often the supervisors send their officers out to take care of an incident and don't show up until the incident is well underway or over. And that is one perspective that the obligations or the duties of supervisors need to be changed. I can go into what sergeants need to do and what lieutenants need to do and what captains need to do and all, and what I can go into that, but I won't at this point. But that needs to be changed. Another is that I believe that the police union in Albuquerque has not been on top of community policing. They have basically stayed with the idea of better pay for police officers. And so the unions have been in the way because they haven't taken an active role into community policing.
I see. Well, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to actually throw this to City Councilor Pat Davis, who is on the line with us today. We're going to be talking with Pat Moore. But just for this question, I want to go to Pat Davis. Good morning, Pat. Are you there?
Yes, sir. Good morning, Ty. Thanks for having me join.
Certainly. And now you are a former police officer yourself, and I wondered if you had any thoughts on what Casey had to say about policing in Albuquerque.
Well, I think overall, I think the community agrees. I agree. This has been our challenge. If you look at the list of Department of Justice reforms, Albuquerque's checked every box. But community policing involves like community and policing. And as I said the other day, and I've said a number of times, our police department on whole has not yet bought into the reforms, and the community doesn't see community policing at all, much less whether it works. And so we have a long way to go. The police union is not helpful. They are a party to the DOJ reforms, the only place in the country where the police union is required by DOJ to do some certain things. But you hear their police union president say last week that they hope all the police reform initiatives fail. And I think that doesn't represent the views of most of the 200 new police officers we hired in the last 2 years, who are obviously mostly younger, but they come into the department knowing they're going to wear a camera. They want to ride a bicycle. They want to work a foot beat. They want to do social work and community policing. And we don't have an infrastructure yet to enable that to happen. And that's a lot of the frustration.
Well, let's go back to that Police Officers Association. The city is about to renegotiate its contract with the Police Officers Association. That contract would lock in place some details like how investigations and discipline are carried out, pay provisions, and other protocols that activists are currently criticizing, that I think Casey was mentioning in terms of how a supervision structure works. Some say the city should not sign a new contract until reforms have been implemented with community input. Are you doing anything to ensure that a new contract doesn't hinder those reforms?
Yeah, and they're right. I mean, I do want to point out that the police officers union, their contract on accountability right now does require them to participate in the civilian police oversight, and they have been doing that work. And you see the DOJ's reforms that say that that piece works. But here's my concern. The law requires the mayor to notify the city council, which is essentially a public notification, when they begin negotiating a new contract. We learned in the last few weeks that, in fact, they have started that process with APOA earlier this year and didn't notify us. But under the city's charter and under labor laws, the mayor can negotiate directly with the labor union without any public oversight, without disclosing those negotiations, and without the ability of the city council to approve anything but a proposed raise, which I don't support because we've given them enough money in the last few years. So our challenge at the city council is that we have announced a series of hearings in July, and we're going to have a public hearing on what the union wants, what the mayor's position is, so the public can weigh in. But unfortunately, in New Mexico and in the city of Albuquerque, those negotiations are exclusive between the mayor and the APOA. So for folks that are concerned, we want them to call the mayor and ask for that same thing.
And when will those? When will that meeting in July take place?
It'll be up to Councilor Benton, who's the chair of that committee, to make that announcement. And we'll make that announcement on June 29th at our next city council meeting. But we're negotiating with the mayor's office about when to do that.
Okay. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about you, of course, represent the International District here in Albuquerque. A lot of people in that community have complained about what they see as over-policing, that there's a great concentration of police officers there pulling people over for what seem like minor crimes, kind of a broken windows approach. What do you say in response to people who feel like there's too much of a police presence there, that it's unfair, that they should be subject to that sort of scrutiny?
I agree. You know, one of the things about doing this work and being sort of coming from an advocacy role is that we have to be willing to challenge our friends. I mean, we remember what happened when a UNM baseball player was shot in Nob Hill by a young African-American man. And what the community knows is that that alleged shooter didn't even live in the International District. They lived in off of Gibson and I-25. But the response was for the state police to do a surge and the sheriff's department to do a surge in the International District, mostly because that neighborhood looked like the person who shot. I worked with black church leaders and black organizations. You know, we asked the governor to remove the state police. We asked the sheriff to let us police again in our districts and to help focus on gun violence overall and not just in those neighborhoods. But the fact is they're right. And it's incredibly frustrating because every time the community says we want to start a community police council, we want to start a new dialogue, some outside factor like the U.S. Attorney's Office in 2016. Under the former U.S. attorney just started doing undercover operations to target mostly black and brown, homeless and low-income people for drug and gun violations. And you end up with a federal judge that says it was designed or structured in a way that was likely to ensnare more minorities than the folks actually doing the crimes. Going into barbershops and black-owned restaurants trying to solicit guns, for example. Mm-hmm. That was not Albuquerque police, but it doesn't help. Yeah, that was the Fed.
Right.
That was the former U.S. attorney who's now the mayor's chief public safety advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And so the folks have a real criticism of our relationship with policing and their right to be skeptical. And so when I say that's why we've checked the boxes for community policing but haven't done it, that's the reason.
Okay. I have a call on from Christopher. Also in Albuquerque. Good morning, Christopher. What is your what's your comment today?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ty. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
My name is Christopher Ramirez, and I'm with a group called Together for Brothers. And one of the things I just want to comment on is we focus on building capacity for young men of color, ages 12 to 24 years old, here in Albuquerque.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hearing from both young men and families about feeling really unsafe for the reasons that I've heard Marissa and Zoe talked about, and that is the militarization of police, where young people are seeing and hearing and experiencing snipers and tear gas and riot gear, rubber bullets, where that doesn't feel like it's appropriate. And I want to be able to talk about that, where we have a police force that has been funded to the tune of almost $200 million. And I appreciate the city councilor also talking about the surge, where it's not just city police, but it's also county, state, and other law enforcement that we're seeing that racially profiles our communities.
Mm-hmm.
So that militarization of police has really made communities unsafe. And I really appreciate what Zoe is saying in terms of having community conversations about what it would mean to defund the police and shift those resources to other communities. And I want to end by just saying, agreeing with the city councilor, that state surge, from our understanding, cost at least $1 million for a month of over-policing that wasn't coordinated with either the city or county law enforcement. And I think about what $1 million in the International District could have done other than, right, racial profiling and citations of over 1,200 people that led only to 12 convictions, and none of them made our community any safer. And so I want to just really talk about the militarization of police and why we're still using tear gas, riot gear, rubber bullets, and even have a tank on the streets of Albuquerque that doesn't make us safer.
Thank you for your call, Christopher. Councillor Davis, what are you doing about the militarization of the police force?
Yeah, and Christopher's right, and Chris knows he's done a lot of really amazing work in the particularly in the International District, and I appreciate him. And he's one of those folks that's helping us have conversations when, quite frankly, others are afraid to step up or have given up. And so I appreciate that. You know, Councilor Senna and I introduced legislation a couple of weeks ago to ban APD from receiving any new military equipment. That wasn't an issue. The last time we received sort of armored personnel or military rifles was in 2015, before I was on the city council. And President Obama stopped that program essentially by executive order. But now President Trump has rolled that back, and you hear him telling governors and mayors to militarize their police. And so we introduced legislation to ban APD from participating in that program. All of that equipment is out of service now. So in other words, the equipment we have today is for civilian law enforcement use. But quite frankly, the civilian equipment mirrors a lot of the military equipment as well. And so we have to take a look at that. And that is Chris is articulating exactly the concern that Councilor Benton and I did yesterday. In the last 2 years, we've added 40% to the budget of Family and Community Services, $23 million for community orgs. That's half of the increase that we've increased APD's budget. And I had my staff identify $1 million from APD's budget this year, end of year budget. We've only got another month left that we would put into community organizations. But that's just a start. Like, that's why the mayor and I want to do this new department to have social workers doing the work.
Let me pause you there for a moment. I do want to go back to the militarization question. What about the military style equipment that the police in Albuquerque already have? Is there a way to kind of roll that back so that they aren't using that on the streets during protests or what have you?
Yeah, and just to be clear, like we said, the military equipment we acquired in 2015 is no longer in service, and our legislation prohibits them from getting new stuff. But I think we want to be honest. We saw a few weeks ago on a Sunday afternoon that an active shooter with an assault rifle was terrorizing an apartment complex. Like, our officers need armored equipment to get in there and stop that guy. So there is a place for that. But when we look at what happened downtown on Monday night, we talk about de-escalation as a strategy on the street for the individual officer. But as a former cop, I got to tell you, de-escalation starts way before that. That incident that happened on Monday, when you have a peaceful prayer vigil, another group coming to tear down the statue, and an armed militia who had deputized themselves to be the police if the police weren't present. We knew those groups were all coming to one place at one time. And my challenge to the city was why did we not step in to intervene to prevent that from happening? Why didn't we put up a fence around the statue to take it out of play? If we knew they were coming, why didn't we organize the streets better to give everybody a space to peacefully protest and express their opinion without allowing them to clash uninhibited for almost 10 minutes on that site as tensions escalated? Those are the concerns we really have. And when you take a step back and look at why we have deployed those military-style tactics and equipment on the street, like tanks or tear gas as a riot control device, it's because at the end of the day, something's gone wrong. We failed to either protect life or protect property, and that's the ultimate goal of law enforcement. And so when those things happen, it means something's gone wrong, and we have to be able to ask the right questions. So far, I've been unsatisfied with the answers we've gotten from the folks in charge who are making those decisions about why they continue to allow those activities to occur, why they know, if they know these things are going to happen, why they don't intervene earlier. And I think that's the de-escalation we have to talk about.
Okay, we have another quick break here. You are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. We'll be back in a minute.
Support provided by Weekly Alibi, covering news, arts, and entertainment for Albuquerque since 1992. The friends at Weekly Alibi invite the community to help support local independent journalism when it's needed the most. Info at alibi.com/friends.
Support comes from Il Vicino Wood Oven Pizza Restaurants, safely offering curbside pickup at all locations from 5 till 8 and delivery service through DoorDash 7 days a week. Call-in orders accepted and can be placed online through ilvicino.com.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, the story of a man who launched a little-known investigation to stop abuses by law enforcement on the U.S.-Mexico border. The kicker? This was 101 years ago.
He wholeheartedly believes that if you show the ways in which people are being denied due process, that that is going to alarm politicians.
That's next time on Latino USA.
Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. This morning we are hearing different calls for change in policing. What do you think is the best way to end police violence and excessive use of force? There is still time to call in this morning at 277-5866. We have a call from Scott. Good morning, Scott. What's your question or comment today?
Good morning. I just want to like to comment that what I've seen happening around the country is the enforcement of two forms of justice, and one being a form of justice for armed white males, and then a form of justice for black and brown people. And you will notice that several years ago when the white supremacist protests happened in Charlottesville, there were police there, but they weren't blocking the street and firing tear gas and rubber bullets at them and surrounding them and rounding them up and taking them away, but because they know that there will be a shootout, and then they don't want to like have that kind of war, but they will pick on unarmed people who are mostly nonviolent, and because they know they can win. And if you want to have a successful police force, you need to take away the weapons from the police too. And that there are many models that show that of nonviolent policing, you know, the more we arm the police, the more likely they're going to show up to a situation and shoot first and ask questions later because they're hyped up on sugar and caffeine. They've had a stressful day. They're ready to do some damage. If we take away their toys, they won't do this anymore, or at least it'll, you know, diminish their ability to do it.
Okay. Thank you for your call, Scott. Joining us now is Celinda Guerrero, activist and organizer with Building Power for Black New Mexico and Albuquerque Mutual Aid. Good morning, Celinda.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Certainly. Thank you for coming on. Tomorrow is Juneteenth, which honors the day the last black slaves were told they were free in 1865. Some argue that the systems of slavery only adapted to a new world since then. Could you elaborate on that and how that relates to policing and criminal justice in New Mexico today?
Absolutely. I think it's important for us to acknowledge our history if we're ever going to have truth and reconciliation with the systems of violence and oppression that we're dealing with today through state violence. And so I just want to read out loud the loophole that was left in the 13th Amendment. And it reads, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction.
And it literally uses the word slavery there.
It literally does. And so, you know, if we've been criminalized, then it's legal for the United States to hold us as slaves. And this loophole was left in intentionally. And what we saw after, you know, post-Civil War and, you know, is that immediately as our ancestors were being freed, they were criminalized and then contracted back through convict leasing to the very plantations they had just been freed from. Mm-hmm. And this loophole was left in, from what we understand historically, was because of capitalism in the South. They wanted to preserve the Southern economy. And that's why Lincoln negotiated this loophole, so that they could have a mechanism, a tool to do that. And none of that has changed. Mm-hmm. The system's only gotten more sophisticated and evolved into what we see today, which is, you know, the prison industrial complex, where states are still contracting out slave labor to industries like Boeing and JCPenney, Victoria's Secret, Idaho Potatoes are farmed and manufactured on a plantation in Idaho where prisoners grow and package potatoes. So I think it's important for us to reconcile with what that history is.
And do you see
in our prisons, they manufacture, there's a person on paid staff at the governor's office to sell the products that prisoners manufacture in New Mexico.
So do you see a through line from the, you know, racist South prior to the Civil War to the way that there is a racial bias in modern day policing?
Absolutely. I would argue that almost nothing has changed. You know, I heard the last caller was stating how they can see the difference in how people in the country are policed. And, you know, I give political education workshops where I often argue that the only role of police in the society is to protect the wealthy and their resources and control people of color and the poor. They're nothing more than modern day slave catchers. That is literally what their function is in our society.
Okay, we're going to come back to you in just a second, Celinda, but we do have some breaking news. The U.S. Supreme Court this morning has ruled 5-4 to uphold Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, the DACA program. That is a ruling against the Trump administration, which sought to end the program, and this ensures that Dreamers are able to avoid deportation and remain in the U.S. You can find live special coverage of the decision from NPR News Now or online at KUNM.org. We're going to keep you updated on that story this morning on air after Let's Talk New Mexico and on our website. Okay, Celinda, let's go back to our conversation. Your husband, Clifton White, was arrested after one of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations in May. You said that that was retaliation for your organizing. Clifton was charged with violating parole. How does the way parole works contribute to this the oppressive systems that you've described?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was really interesting to me, and I'm so grateful for the outpouring of support from our community and our network, our international network, outpouring of support for my family. Clifton was retaliated against by the Albuquerque Police Department because we have them on video doing illegal activity and kidnapping young people from our neighborhood in a tank. And we were there to try to protect the people. Clifton was illegally arrested by an Albuquerque task force, Albuquerque Police Task Force, on June the 1st. He was arrested without a warrant. He was taken to MDC, which Albuquerque Police nor MDC, for those of us that are familiar with this system, do not act on parole, administrative parole retakes. And MDC does not have the jurisdiction to even house somebody who's on a parole retake. They're supposed to go right back to DOC. So we saw lots of places where they weren't following their own rules, mm-hmm. which is not unusual for people in my neighborhood. They never do. But it's,
and I want to point out,
people must understand what a parole retake is. So he is considered state property while he is on parole. He's mm-hmm. he's literally labeled state property. These are humans called state property. Now, the system can, at its will, violate somebody's parole, their ability to move about the society, and take them back into the prison system. For anything, literally. The police could come and talk to them, and that police contact could lead them back to prison. And so Clifton is on an administrative parole retake. Mm-hmm. He's not entitled to legal counsel. There's no relief in with a judge or a DA or outside of the Department of Corrections and the governor. Mm-hmm. This system does not permit him to have any rights to produce witnesses for himself, to defend himself in any way.
So he cannot appeal, is what you're saying?
So he can. There is one path, and it's called a habeas corpus petition. And the problem with the habeas corpus is that path can sometimes, it leads to the Court of Appeals, which often will take a 3-5 year process, where New Mexico parole terms are on average 1 to 2 years. And by the time it gets there, these cases get dumped with no opportunity for remedy. And so we have not yet been able to set case law to show how New Mexico is illegally using parole terms to enhance sentences here. Okay. And so this is Clifton's situation. He's not entitled to legal counsel. He's not entitled to defend himself. The system will most likely, they were asking to max him out, which means he's going to be sent back to prison for the duration of whatever his parole's left, which he just came home in September. He just got home to us in September. Mm-hmm. And so for him to be kidnapped from our family in this state to steal more years from my family is devastating. This Absolutely. Is a seventh illegal parole term on the same sentence that dates back to 2001.
I'm sorry to hear that, and I hope that your family is able to get through that. I'm sure they will. You, like Zoe, are calling for an abolition of the Albuquerque Police Department and replacing it with community alliances and community practices. I wonder if you could describe for me a little bit about how that would work. What are some of these community alliances and practices that could do some of the work that police do now?
So something that we understand quite clearly in my community, and I just want to, you know, I grew up as an impacted person in the valley and in the southeast of Albuquerque. My mom's side of the family is from New Mexico. They were here before this was the United States. And so, you know, we're deeply rooted here. My dad grew up in the South picking cotton and eating in Jim Crow kitchens. I feel like I'm at the intersection of ethnicity, and so I'm speaking as an impacted person. What I know, and what I know for my people, is that violence is a symptom of people in the struggle. When we're starving, when we can't feed our children, when we can't find housing and we're sleeping outside in parks on the cold concrete, like these are the conditions that we're fighting just for our own existence in. And we live in the wealthiest country in the world. There is absolutely no reason that people in this country should be suffering this way. We have enough resources to protect and help our people. Because of racial capitalism, we've chosen not to. And so if people have their basic necessities met, housing, food, health care, shelter, education, the things that we need simply to exist, you would see crime almost disappear. Mm-hmm. Now, there would be things still, like mental health issues, substance abuse issues, but all of those, you would see them start to diminish. When people's needs are met, those things almost disappear. And we saw some of that at the beginning of the pandemic when this massive redistribution of resources went to the bottom. Everybody kept saying, "Oh, well, the crime is down. There hasn't been a homicide in weeks. I don't understand. Well, yes, we understand because our needs are being met. Mm-hmm. We're not fighting to exist every day. And so what I argue is that police and prison abolition has nearly nothing to do with the police themselves or the prisons. It has everything to do with building a healthy society that does not need those systems.
So that's the priority there. That makes, I understand what you're saying. I want to go to Gwyneth on line 3. Good morning, Gwyneth. Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico.
Thank you for taking my call. And Ms. Guerrero says it perfectly. It's fabulous.
Oh, did we lose Gwyneth?
Are you there?
I am, yeah. Okay, here we go. Go ahead. Continue.
I have met the police recruiter from APD numerous times at business events, and every time I go up to him and I say, "Hi, how are you?" And "What are you looking for at, you know, whom are you looking to recruit?" Every time he says, "We're looking for people who've been in the Middle East in war." Mm-hmm. And I do not understand how that could possibly make APD or Albuquerque safer, because as long as people are in the military, they are trained to see everybody that is not theirs as the enemy. Mm-hmm. And we in this town are not the enemy. And then there's the added thing of when you add flak jackets and dress up like war people, people in war, it's like Halloween. Anybody who puts on a costume is going to take on some part of that mm-hmm. persona. So I totally agree in changing the police into serving the community. But until we get there, I'd love to get there today. Okay. Meanwhile.
Well, thank you very much, Gwyneth. That is a question I'd like to put to Daryl Lorenzo Wellington. Daryl is a poet, writer, and activist in Santa Fe. Good morning, Daryl. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm still here. Yes.
Great. Thank
Hello,
you.
Ty.
Thank you for your patience this morning. Now, Gwyneth called in talking about the military aspect of modern day policing. And I know that a big part of your message in Santa Fe, when you're working with, you know, Black Lives Matter and other organizations, has been to demilitarize and disarm the police in many situations. Can you tell me why that's important?
Well, I mean, a lot of this has been covered from what I was listening to. Police departments are funded in the billions. A lot of people don't realize that. When you look at the funding we have for them in the United States, it's more than the entire military expense of several other countries. And so just as the previous person was saying, a lot of that money could be diverted to other resources. Police themselves often complain that they're hired to do social work. They spend so much time dealing with the homeless. They spend so much time dealing with drug addiction issues. Well, why not just fund better facilities to deal with the homeless and deal mm-hmm. with drug addiction issues? I mean, I do speak more to defunding the police than necessarily abolishing the mm-hmm. police, though it may come that we do mature as a society well enough to do that. But the sort of excess weaponry, you know, with mm-hmm. tanks, semi-automatics, most police work actually involves handing out speeding tickets, answering noise violation. What? I don't even see why you need a weapon at all, mm-hmm. much less artillery.
Daryl, I wanted to ask you, you just published an article with the Santa Fe Reporter yesterday. It's entitled, Is Santa Fe Ready for Black Lives Matter? What's your answer there, is it?
Well, the point of thank you, Ty. The point of the article was to ask a question, not necessarily mm-hmm. pose a answer. You're a journalist. You understand sure. that sometimes. I actually don't know the answer to that. I mean, we're switching gears here. Well, not totally. New Mexico has a very small black population, and yet the Black Lives Matter movement has, thankfully, been very responsible for throwing a lot of attention on issues of police brutality, which certainly affect us in New Mexico. And in Santa Fe, too, actually. Since we talked, I found some more information about that. Okay. But I don't know how well. I think New Mexico, let's expand that beyond Santa Fe. I think New Mexico, with its immense problems with police brutality and its immense historical problems, definitely should be and could be ready for Black Lives Matter.
Well, I'm giving you the last word there. Thank you so much, Daryl. That is all the time that we have today. Thanks to everyone who called in to share their thoughts. Thanks so much to our guests, Marisa DeMarco, Zoe Kraft, Pat Davis, Celinda Guerrero, and Daryl Lorenzo Wellington. Let's keep this conversation going. Share your thoughts on Twitter, hashtag Let's Talk NM, on Facebook, search for KUNM Radio, or email letstalk@KUNM.org. If you missed part of the show, you can stream it online or subscribe to our podcast, which you can find wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Kaveh Movahed screened your calls. Taylor Velasquez live tweeted the show today. Hannah Colton produced the show. I'm Ty Bannerman. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.